Colonel Beaver, Reel 1. When were you born, Colonel Beaver?
1st March 1905.
Where was this?
Newark-on-Trent, Nottinghamshire.
What did your father do for a living?
He was a country solicitor with the taste of his class. He was almost a first-class shot. In his younger days, he hunted a bit, but when he had two children, he couldn't afford to keep it up. So I was brought up in a sporting atmosphere. He was a keen shot, a keen player of ball games such as tennis and golf and cricket.
Where were you educated?
Bramcote Scarborough, where I was bombarded by the German Navy in December 1914. Then Winchester College, where I got a scholarship, and then New College, Oxford. So I am a Wickhamist in both sense.
Do you remember the German bombardment?
Oh, yes.
Can you describe what happened?
It happened at 8 o'clock in the morning, just as we were all sitting down to breakfast in the school hall. And shells landed in the playground outside. And immediately after the bombardment ceased, which went on for perhaps half an hour or more, the masters sensibly took us all out behind a local hill called Oliver's Mount, where we were really effectively out of range of naval bombardment. The masters also, I think, behaved rather sensibly, that after it was all over, they sent us all home by train, so that the boys in the school would get home before the parents even heard the news, which in 1914 there was no radio. And in fact, I got home to Nottinghamshire, and my parents knew nothing about the bombardment of Scarborough.
Was it a terrifying experience?
Not as much as I expected. I mean, it was a shock, because I mean, we were literally sitting down to breakfast, and shells started falling in the playground outside. It wasn't a terrifying experience as I'd expected, but it was certainly a bit of a shock to everybody. And in those days, anyway, there were relatively few people who'd been under fire at the age, say, in my case, of 8.
Were some of the children very much upset? Were they crying?
I don't recall any case of emotional upheavals.
What kind of damage was done?
To the school, very little. To some of the houses on the more or less on the seafront, there was quite a lot of damage. I don't recall anything about casualties. I don't think there were many casualties. It was a rather misty morning, and Scarborough was not the only place on the coast, on the northeast coast, which was bombarded by the German Navy on that day. Because obviously two or three or more naval squadrons got through owing to the mist, and I forget the names of, I think, Whitby and Hartlepool and one or two others were bombarded, and the casualties were remarkably few. There was, of course, great indignation in the country as a whole, at enemy bombardment of civilian objectives with no military value.
Was there shrapnel all over the place?
Oh yes, you picked up. I think I picked up a piece of shell fragment.
Hot? Was it hot?
I really don't recall. I expect it was, but I don't recall.
Now, after you went to public school, you went to Oxford, did you?
Yes.
And which college was that?
It was New College.
What did you read there?
I read Mods and Greats, Honor, Moderations, and Literae Humaniores.
When did you leave?
1928. I was up at Oxford from 1924 to 1928, 4 years.
What did you do when you left?
I wanted to be an archaeologist, but in those days, it wasn't that they didn't pay you a living wage to be an archaeologist, they didn't pay you anything at all, and that I couldn't afford, and I'd been under pressure from my father to become a lawyer and to follow in his footsteps. He always wanted me to become a country lawyer in Nottinghamshire, which has certain attractions, and you don't make much money, but you meet on quite an interesting lot of people. Some at least of your clients are well-to-do people with estates, and you probably get a fair amount of shooting and other sporting activities. But when I was at Oxford, I was really in two minds as to whether to become a solicitor or a barrister, on the assumption that I could never afford to be an archaeologist. I was introduced to a well-known Chancery QC, Casey he was then, who subsequently became a Chancery judge, and he was none other than Crossman J, the father of Dick Crossman, who later on was at Winchester with me. In fact, he was head of the school two years after I was.
How did you come to be recruited to SOE?
Sometime about 1938, my firm, Slaughter and May, who were one of the leading firms in the city in the field of what is now called corporation law, and we handled a great many prospectuses and issues and company matters, and at that time I was a qualified solicitor, but I was not yet a partner in the firm, and I and a partner with whom I did a great deal of work, who was one of the ablest lawyers I ever knew, and we handled one particular issue for a company, a well-known public company, where one of the part-time directors was Sir Frank Nelson, who later became the first head of SOE. And he was obviously impressed with the performance of my partner and myself. And very soon after he became head of SOE in, I think it was July or August 1940, and he was the first head, he got hold of my partner and persuaded him to join an organization about which nobody knew anything. And after he'd persuaded my partner, he said to him, What about that man Beaver who worked with you on that company matter? You and he seem to get on pretty well together. And at a later stage in November, and I was then a territorial gunnery officer in the anti-aircraft field, and I got a sudden summons from London to attend for an urgent interview.
Who was your partner?
Hugh Quennell. Same as Quennell, the author, but he always pronounced it Quennell. And he was a very quick thinking, sharp man, who was sharp in the good sense. I mean, he was one of the leading lawyers in the city at the time. And he was in SOE. He was a bit, he had a mischievous strain in him and rather enjoyed being the enfant terrible, particularly when he had anything to do with the man who was Member of Parliament for Chelsea at that time, none other than Sir Samuel Hoare, who of course at that very time was being made ambassador in Madrid. And so there were plenty of opportunities for clash. And in fact, I remember Sam Hoare was himself in World War I, was in MI6 in Russia. I think, I forget whether it was Moscow or, and he knew about Secret Service work. And like most ambassadors, but with the benefit of experience, he was very anti any Secret Service operating in his territory, because it was a possible and probable source of embarrassment and would tend to deprive him of the credit which would otherwise be his. And I remember there was an occasion, he appointed a very capable naval attaché, Alan Hilgarth, to be his representative to deal with all secret services, whether it was escapes or intelligence or, as in our case, potential resistance. And Hilgarth, they were all told to report to Hilgarth and not to trouble the ambassador. And there was an occasion, I think it would have been sometime in 1941, when the Germans organized a demonstration against the British embassy and got a crowd together who threw rocks at and broke the windows. And the Spanish police were persuaded to look the other way. And it so happened my friend and partner at that time, at that particular moment, he was in Gibraltar, and he sent a cable to Hilgarth, the naval attaché, saying, "This was not, repeat not, my doing."
Now, you said that you had to go for interview in November 1940.
Yes.
Can you remember what happened at that interview?
I remember very well, because at the end of it, I was really no wiser than I had been at the beginning as to what this organization was intended to do. The interviewers were under orders not to disclose the function of SOE, even its name. It had a cover name of ISRB, the Inter-Services Research Bureau, which of course was Scheer cover name, and offices in 64 Baker Street. I was not unique. Nobody, after his interview, really knew what it was all about. You were told, this is a new secret organization. We won't tell you what its objectives are until you've been cleared for security. And I very nearly said no, because they simply wouldn't tell me anything. I, at that time, as I said, I was a territorial gunner, and I didn't think that was going to be a very exciting form of warfare. We obviously weren't going to go back to the continent or go abroad anywhere in the world for months, if not years. And I saw no particular attraction in joining a secret organization, and I didn't even know its name or objective. But it so happened that I came out to London from the place where I was being attached to a field gunnery unit. I was on the point of going to the Staff College at Sandhurst, and I was attached temporarily to a field gunnery unit down in Gloucestershire. My own house was out of action owing to damage by the enemy, and I stayed with an old friend who had temporarily rented a house in Regent's Park, and he was then working in the War Office, and shortly afterwards was sent to Washington as British military attaché there. He had also another guest staying with him called Beaumont Nesbitt, who until quite recently had been Director of Military Intelligence. And the day after my interview, he and I were having breakfast together, and I said, "May I ask your advice? I've been invited to join an organization called the ISRB, and they won't tell me what it's about. Do you think that..." I said, "I'm only a wartime soldier." Sorry. "And it's very unlikely that I shall have a particularly interesting war. I shall probably find myself in some dismal staff duty or supply or something. Do you think an organization like this would be more interesting for a man like myself?" And he said, "I have little doubt that it would." And he was quite correct. He didn't answer my question and tell me what the new organization was going to do, but he was prepared to say that he thought it would be more interesting for a wartime soldier like myself than continuing in the army. And so I took his advice and I said yes. And then I had a talk with, I forget who it was, certainly it must have been my former partner, among others, but I probably had one or two talks with one or two people in SOE. And I ceased to be a territorial gunner within the week, and was, as the jargon goes, I was seconded for special employment, which means that your name is taken off the army list and you cease to have any official existence.
Can you remember at the interview what type of information they were trying to get from you about you?
Well, I think they were asking questions very similar to what you've been asking, my background, education, what I'd been doing since the war began, which was easy. I was a territorial officer, I don't remember anything specific apart from that. Their interviewing system was pretty good. I mean, if somebody had a weakness, of course they were always asking about languages, and I was not a great linguist. I said, well, I speak a certain amount of French and quite a bit of Italian, because my first wife had been brought up in Italy and naturally spoke Italian before she spoke English. But no, I don't remember anything else of interest.
Do you remember who conducted the interview? Or how many of them there were?
I ought to, but I don't, and I don't think I did. When I wrote this book, I know my memory is worse now than it was 5 years ago.
So what was the next step once you'd accepted employment with them?
Well, I had to come back, of course, and live in London. And my house being out of action, I went to live with another friend who was temporarily living somewhere in Regent's Park. And I reported for duty at 64 Baker Street, where I discovered that my peacetime partner had been made the head of H Section, which dealt with Spain and Portugal. I should explain, as you would see from, I think, from Michael Foote's big book, and almost any book on SOE, that they were organized. There were country sections, and there was a French section, Belgian and so on, Norwegian, a Scandinavian section. They were either country sections or regional sections. And this being November 1940, the H section dealing with Iberia was obviously important because the British government and secret services were all wrongly convinced that Hitler's next step after the fall of France was going to be to invade the peninsula and cross the Pyrenees with all the help they could get from Franco, and then try to capture Gibraltar, which would have enabled him to close the entrance to the Mediterranean. And his failure, I think, to go into the Iberian Peninsula really lost him the war, or lost him the chance of at least surviving the war. I mean, he would have been able to play, he would have been able to play for a draw if he could have blocked the Mediterranean. We would never then have been able to launch Operation Torch, which was the landing in North Africa in
1943.
November 42, isn't it?
42, yes.
42, I think. It was the year I left Lisbon. And I had a bit over two weeks in London trying to learn from people who'd had some experience, not necessarily in war, but some experience of clandestine operations, and some experience there working in enemy territory and observing security. And, of course, above all, I had to be instructed in the use of explosives and the obvious weapon training. And I was only 2 weeks in London before I went out to Portugal on, I think it was the 2nd of January 1941.
Had you ever been there before?
Never. That was my only defense when after I'd arrived in Lisbon, when people said, as they frequently did, "Do you speak Portuguese?" And I said, "No." "Well, why did they send you here?" And I said, "Well, you know, the War Office is like, they always send you to a place where you have no qualification." And that answer always conveyed complete conviction.
What, in fact, did you know about Iberia? Anything in particular?
No. No. No, I don't think I'd ever been either to Spain or Portugal at that time. And, no, they wanted somebody who had the qualities they were after, who was sensible and didn't lose his head, and could be relied on to carry out orders. When you've been a lawyer in a big firm, you do have a sense of security. I mean, you're constantly involved in large and secret operations, which in the interest of your clients, you must keep absolutely secret. And so my partner and I, and two or three other partners in the same firm who were recruited later on, started with the advantage that they could presume we were security minded.
Did you feel, in the light of what happened later, that your lack of Iberian background was any disadvantage?
You could always get somebody locally and from the British colony. I eventually got a man from the Signal Corps who spent most of his life in Brazil. I was quite a youngish man, but he spoke fluent Portuguese with a Brazilian accent, and he was recruited and sent out, and he was invaluable to me.
Was it easy to get out to Lisbon in those days?
No, because the German long-range bombers were based at a base called Merignac near Bordeaux, and they could fly a very long way out into the Atlantic. And so any British or other Allied aircraft flying to Lisbon or Gibraltar had to fly on a practically semicircular course out west to sea, and then in order to try and keep out of range of the German long-range bombers. Curious enough, they hardly ever, I think only on one occasion, did they shoot down an Allied aircraft flying on that route, and that was the case of, there's a famous actor who was shot down, and another man I knew on that aircraft. That was about 1942, I think. But anyway, cynics used to say the Germans don't want to shoot down these aircraft because they're certainly carrying German agents to Britain, to or from.
What were your impressions when you got to Lisbon?
Well, of course, one was amazed after a year of war and blackout and rationing to find a neutral city. Where you had your headlights on and the street lights were on, no rationing, and everything as in peacetime. The Portuguese were very conscientious, rather unlike the Spaniards, in separating or trying to separate representatives of the belligerents. And they wouldn't have asked a German military attaché and a British military attaché to the same ceremony, or put them side by side. The Spaniards really couldn't care less. I think they rather enjoyed demonstrating the enmity of the belligerents and demonstrating how wise their government was in maintaining neutrality. We, of course, always want, it was a cardinal issue of British policy, as practiced by Sir Samuel Hoare with the full approval of Churchill,